This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 18. Zhao Zhou's dog. A pointer. A gourd floating on the water. Push it down and it turns. A jewel in the sunlight. It has no definite shape. It cannot be attained by mindlessness, nor known by mindfulness. Immeasurably great people are turned about in the stream of words. Is there anyone who can escape? Case. A student asked Master Zhao Zhou, does the dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhao Zhou said, yes. The student said, since it has, why is it then in this skin bag? Zhao Zhou said, because it knows, yet deliberately transgresses. Another student later asked Master Zhao Zhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhao Zhou said, no. The student said, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why does a dog have none then? Zhao Zhou said, because it still has impulsive consciousness. The verse. A dog's Buddha nature exists. A dog's Buddha nature does not exist. A straight hook basically seeks fish who turn away from life. Chase in the air, pursuing fragrance, cloud and water travelers. In noisy confusion, they make excuses and explanations. Making an even presentation, he throws the shop wide open. Don't blame him for not being careful in the beginning. Pointing out the flaw, he takes away the jewel. The king of Qin didn't know Lian Zhangru. So bringing out the old dog again. As many of you know, this part of this koan is the first koan of the Women Koan, which is a Rinzai or Linji school collection of koans. Book of Serenity is a collection of koans that came out of the Hongzhi, the Soto school. And Mu is used as the first koan in the Women Koan. And in koan training, it is traditionally been one of the few koans that is used as the first koan. And in that case, woman just pulls out this one part. Does the dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhao Zhou says, Mu. That's the totality of it, the koan as it appears in the Women Koan, because it is the first koan. And so the first koan within the koan tradition has a very particular role as helping the student to come to what is typically a first breakthrough via the koan, which is a very particular way of studying the mind and realizing self-nature. Not so much realizing self-nature, but a upaya to bring one to that. In this case, there's two different dialogues that Hongzhi brings together as one, to look at two aspects of this. So same question, in one case, Zhao Zhou answers affirmatively, in one case, he says no. Mu in Japanese means no. And so what I wanted to do is first take the latter half of this today, and then in my next talk, I'll take the first half. Does a dog have Buddha nature? So Buddha nature is a very important term within Mahayana Buddhism. It didn't really appear early Buddhism. The Buddha, there are ways that it can be sort of pulled out in a sense. The Buddha often said the mind of students of the way is luminous, but it's defiled by adventitious defilements. The mind is luminous. Its very nature is luminous. But it appears defiled, it appears, is cloudy because of our defilements. Master Dogen wrote a whole fascicle on Buddha nature. And in it, he quotes the Buddha saying, living beings all are Buddha nature. The Tathagata is continuously abiding and not subject to change. The Tathagata means the one thus come, the one thus gone, another name for the Buddha. Living beings all are Buddha nature. Buddha continuously abides and is not subject to change. Buddha nature continuously abides in impermanence, within impermanence, in a state of non-abiding. It's not changing, and therefore it can't be lost. So Buddha nature is sometimes referred to as the potential, and sometimes in early Buddhism was, or in early Mahayana Buddhism was understood as the potential to realize self-nature, to realize Buddhahood, Buddha mind, enlightenment. And so we can think of it that way, that without that potential, what are we doing here? Right? We'd be wasting our time. But that also sets up a kind of a problem, because it seems as though it's something that is not yet, it's like a cake that hasn't yet been baked. It's ingredients that are somehow incipient or information, but not yet brought to full potential. And that is a Buddha nature. Living beings all are Buddha nature from the beginning, already. And so more to the point, it really speaks to our enlightened nature, our basic nature, which is undefiled, which is free, which is continuously abiding, appearing in non-abiding. Buddha nature itself is not subject to change. When we raise bodhicitta, the mind that seeks, aspires to enlightenment for self and others. In raising bodhicitta, we set out on the bodhisattva path, the one who raises bodhicitta, the one who has such an aspiration. And within that bodhicitta, we have faith, or are beginning to have faith, which gets stronger and stronger, that we have Buddha nature, that is inherent within us. And that brings forth faith and confidence and allows us to be patient because we understand and have faith in the fact that what we are on this path to realize is already present. We brought it with us, we take it wherever we go, and yet it is non-abiding, which means that it's not it's not a thing. Right? If it was a thing, we'd already have it, because we know how to get things. Right? This is not that. And that's part of the whole sort of mystery and magic of bodhicitta, is how can we have faith? So we encounter the Dharma. And maybe for the first time in encountering those teachings, we have the rising of faith in what we're encountering. Or maybe in encountering the Dharma, it's speaking about something that we realize we already knew on some level. How is that? How can that be? Well, that's the nature of faith. It doesn't make sense except to the one who has faith. To the one who has faith, it does make sense in a knowing kind of way, in an embodied kind of way, not in an it's easy to explain kind of way. To realize self-nature in Zen tradition is to realize Buddha nature. Bodhidharma said, to discover Buddha, and of course here, Buddha, remember Buddha means the awakened one, so we use it to refer to Shakyamuni, our first teacher. But Buddha is much larger than one person. It is, doesn't belong to any one thing. And so to discover a Buddha is to discover Buddha nature, is to realize our inherent mind. So Bodhidharma says, to discover Buddha, all you have to do is see your nature. Your nature is Buddha, and Buddha is the one who is free. The truth is, there's nothing that can be found. But to reach such a direct understanding, you will need to practice and train. And this is just one of the plain facts of life within Buddha Dharma, that there is nothing that can be found. It is not a thing. But we will need to, we do need to practice and train in order to realize that. We do need to leave home and take many steps to return home and realize no step needed to be taken. And yet, without having left home, we very, very, it would be very unlikely that we would come to that understanding. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Now, of course, the understanding is that every creature has Buddha nature. All things, living beings, all are Buddha nature. There's no dispute about this. So why does Zhao Zhou say no? The monk asks, their student asks, why does it not have Buddha nature? All things have Buddha nature. And Zhao Zhou says, because it still has impulsive consciousness. Impulsive consciousness is what gives rise to the sense of a self, that it's what is the action, the ground and the action and the fruit of karma. It is our grasping mind. It is adventitious defilements. It's what gives rise to the sense of the chariot. Gauguin was talking yesterday about that metaphor, that simile. That Nagarjuna used. So the sense that there is something called a chariot, and that when you go look for what is chariot, so if you go look into its various parts, wheels, chassis, rails, I don't know what these parts are called, I'm just making it up, fringe, chariot, we can't find chariot in any of those parts, so it's not in the parts, but it certainly isn't apart from the parts. There isn't something we call a chariot over here, and the nature of chariot is actually over there. That doesn't make sense. That's not, can't be true. And yet, we give it a name. And in giving it a name, it seems to assume that position. And once it assumes that position, it comes into existence in our mind. Then, of course, everything follows. It's my chariot. It's my new chariot. It's my very special chariot. And so when I pull into the chariot parking lane, right, and you pull in next to me in your chariot, a little too close, I'm a little concerned, right? Because I don't want you to scratch my chariot. And I look over and see yours, and yours is a little bigger than mine, a little fancier than mine. You got that model I couldn't afford. So now I have envy, and you may have pride. And now I'm concerned because what was so special and fabulous a moment before, now it seems kind of lacking somehow. Bodhidharma says, but to reach an understanding, you will need to practice and train. And I would add, and live it. And live this truth that there is nothing that can be found. In the Lankavatara Sutra, the student asked the Buddha, what is Buddha nature? And Buddha said, it is to realize that there is no self in beings or things. There is nothing that exists within this vehicle or any of its parts or any of the parts of its parts which we can say has any independent, self-existing, separate existence. Chariot, then we realize, is something that I have created in my mind, an idea of something that is whole and complete and has an integrity. It holds together. It has function. I desire it. I possess it. It belongs to me. All of that is happening in them. The chariot doesn't know any of that. And on the basis of that, we spin the world. Nature, just in English, is the basic qualities of something, the inherent qualities of something. The essential character of a person or an animal or a thing, its nature. And when Buddhism went to China, that sense of nature was already very important within the culture. And so the sense of Buddha nature, of something existing within us, which was had this sort of kinship with nature, with the nature of things, with the nature of nature. But here, Buddha nature is that which is present in every creature, every person, every thing, every dog, but it has no inherent characteristics. It is empty of precisely that. That is exactly what it is empty of, any intrinsic characteristic. So when we expect things and want things and demand things to have a fixed characteristic, which is just another way of saying intrinsic, and in that way provide us with a sense of certainty and lead us to want to control because it's in its fixedness, we will continually and predictably be frustrated. And that frustration leads to our disappointment, our dissatisfaction, frustration, more desiring, loss of faith, cynicism, anger, aggressiveness. Upon the Buddha's realized enlightenment, he said, I and all beings together at the same time enter the way. He realized that he and all things are Buddha nature. And in that moment, he realized that he and all things are inherently free. Not inherent in the sense of having a fixed characteristic, but in the sense of it being our nature. When we vow to alleviate the suffering of all beings, we can see that as the day, the moment when every single being is free of all suffering. We can see that as the moment every time a person realizes Buddha nature and they realize that all beings are fundamentally free. But if all this is so, then why does Zhao Zhou say no? In the commentary, it says, if you say a dog's Buddha nature surely exists, then afterwards, Zhao Zhou says no. If it surely does not exist, then he'll say yes. And if you say that to say yes or no is just a temporary response spoken according to the situation, in each, there is some reason. That's why it's said that someone with clear eyes has no nest. He's speaking about Zhao Zhou. So Zhao Zhou is using language, and he means it. But he's speaking from a place where nothing is fixed. including yes and no. But he's using them with their meaning. But he's just not bound by it. It says, the point of this student's question was to broaden their perspective and learning. They didn't base it on their own fundamental endowment. Zhao Zhou said, yes, using poison to get rid of poison, using sickness to cure sickness. And he said, no, for the same reason. And so he says that the student didn't ask the question based on their own fundamental endowment. In other words, not coming from their own wisdom yet. That image in the pointer of the gourd, it's a familiar image. You know, this hollow gourd that's very light. And when you push it down, the force of the water makes it roll out of your hand and then it pops back up. Right? It won't stay down. It just keeps rolling over. It's not fixed. Immeasurably great people are turned about in the stream of words. And this is one of the, you know, the real sort of special qualities of the koans, is that recognizing how powerful words are and how bound we can be by them, we would think that the best course of action is just stay away from them, right? A special transmission outside of words and scriptures. Not reliant on phrases and meaning. And yet, rather, it turns around and uses this poison to cure us. Which means we have to, in our mind, and this is not just with koan practice, but we have to, in our mind, learn how to use language in a way that is not fixed, which means our mind has to become not fixed. Our mind becomes like that gourd. I was listening to an interview with David Stendel Rast, who's a Christian monastic, who's been a monastic. He's quite old. He's in his 90s. He's been a monastic for over 60 years, I think. And he was talking about gratitude. And he said, if you think of it like a cup, that when you're receiving goodness, when you're receiving good things, it's like that cup begins to fill. And at a certain level, we become aware of it. Right? Just a drop or two, we may not be aware that we're actually receiving something. But once the cup reaches a certain level, we begin to be aware that something's happening, that we're receiving some kind of abundance, some sort of generosity. And when the cup begins to fill, he said, all too often we recognize that it's about to overflow and we decide, let's get a bigger cup so I can get more. He said, we should just let it overflow. That, he said, is what we call gratitude. To have no nest. We could just get rid of the cup altogether. And here, Zhao Zhou is not educating the student about Buddhism. What he wants to do is enlighten the student to Buddha Dharma. Zhao Zhou isn't concerned with right or wrong, correct or incorrect. He's not concerned about interpretations. All of those things are already present in the student's question. He wants to help the student break free. Why has the dog have none, no Buddha nature? Zhao Zhou says, because it still has impulsive consciousness. So the samskaras are karmic formations. Gokhan yesterday was talking about when things arise, a thought, an emotion, a memory, that it's not voluntary, which is true, that almost always in that first moment, we haven't, preceding that moment, we didn't decide to have that thought or to bring forth this emotion. And that's a result of our impulse of consciousness, our karmic formations, what's called samskaras, which are part of the teaching of the skandhas. They're in the teaching of dependent origination. In the extensive dictionary of Buddhist terms, they're defined as the formative structures of our body, our bodily, verbal, and psychological activities. This concept, samskara, or impulse of consciousness, is the most polyvalent term in Buddhist psychology. It refers to both the formative activities that help form future structures, as well as to the formations formed through these actions. So one scholar described it as polyvalent, as and we can be building something, be in the midst of building something, the formative actions that help to build a future structure. And then once it's built, we have a building. So it's both the activity of, and it's the thing itself. It's the result. And that result is what arises in that moment. That's impulsive consciousness. And it's a result in without asking, it appears. But it appears because of prior actions, bodily, verbal, psychological thoughts, words, desires, intentions that were intentional, that were voluntary. And so even in this moment, it wasn't, we didn't call it forth. It's arising because of things that we have called forth in the past. And we still shouldn't be upset. Because it makes sense. It makes sense that it arises, this impulse of consciousness. It's the forming of the structures, right, that we create to make sense of everything, to explain everything, so we can look up and say, nice looking chariot. I'd like to go for a ride. So that we can bring forth metta. We can invoke loving kindness. We can aspire. We can raise bodhicitta. And that's so much of what we're working with in Sesshin and just in practice, right? Are these impulsive, this impulsive consciousness, our reaction. Something arises, that in and of itself is just something arising. But what happens next? So that's what the skandhas form. Something arises, there's a sensation, there's a feeling, quality that arises when our sense comes into contact with that thing. And then we feel it in some way. Maybe it's in the good category of things. Maybe it's in the not good category of things. Maybe we're indifferent or apathetic to it. And on the basis of that, we then begin to form a perception. What is this? Because we want to know, right? We want to know what's going on. What's out there? What's in here? Right? That's just a basic human drive to know our world. And so we start to form a perception of it. Right? Based on what? Impulse of consciousness. The moment our mind begins forming, it's not happening in a void or in thin air. It's relying on everything we know, everything we've experienced, drawing from that. From that treasure trove. That's the deepest part of our consciousness. And then we act. We act upon it. And so in this moment, we begin building something new based on the building that just arrived a moment ago, based on the building, the verb, the activity before. And on it goes. This is samsara. And so that's why in practice, in the moment, when that's why mindfulness is so important, we have to notice. We have to recognize something has appeared. And then we have to notice the feeling, the sensation. Right? We have to be engaged in that whole process. And engaged in the sense of observing, holding that in our mindfulness, becoming the first one to know rather than the last. And of course, we experience things that are very light, very simple, they sit on the surface, they come and go, and we experience things that are very, very deep. And that are a result of our own actions, the actions of others, our environments, our families, our society, our world, the whole thing. And it can seem so intractable, right? That's what we get so frustrated with. Why is this still happening? Why is this happening at all? But the fact that it's arising in this moment means it's changing. It's in a moment-to-moment state of change. Thus, it appears. And so, to engage it means to engage it in its changing. Now, rather than just going the same old way, let's shift this. How do we shift this? Through our mindfulness. Through how we respond. Through that impulsive consciousness. And beginning to be a little bit, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more, less impulsive, less reactive. Which means we also have to learn how to be not less and less reactive to our reactivity, right? This is the not judging, this is loving kindness, this is compassion. And when the more we understand it, it makes sense, right? And it also becomes a little less personal. Like, why am I doing this? Why do I keep doing this? We do have a responsibility, right? There were actions in the past. There is going to be an action right now. It is happening within this building here, within this chariot. So all of this is well and good, but why did Zsa Zsa say no? Why did he say no Buddha nature? If there were no Buddha nature, we're wasting our time. Right? If we don't already possess that which we seek, if we are not already in possession of that enlightened mind, then either it doesn't exist, or it doesn't exist in me, which means I'm out of luck, or it does exist and it's out there somewhere. But the Buddha said in all of those cases, that will not liberate because it exists. It's something apart. And so to really feel the power of this, we have to really be that student who has deep faith in Buddha nature. Right? So is the student really asking about the dog? I remember Dada Roshi many, many years ago was doing Dharma encounter, sitting on this seat, and a student came up who had a dog that was really not very friendly. But he loved this dog so. You remember, Jejo? And he came up and he said, I have a friend who's not very friendly. People don't really like my friend. And Dada Roshi said, are you talking about your dog? Of course we're concerned about, is it me? And so he says no. And so, but that no has power. It gains power in the moment when we really, when you're the one who has faith in Buddha nature. And you want to realize that. And you're asking this great teacher who you have trust in and faith in for guidance. And this teacher says, no. And the ground disappears from under your feet and you're falling. Why? Why doesn't the dog have Buddha nature? Because it still has impulsive consciousness. So now as you're falling, he sends that after you. And so this no is really reserved for those who are seeking yes. That's what he means in the poem. A straight hook basically seeks fish who turn away from life. The commentary says, a straight harpoon catches ferocious dragons. A curved hook catches clams. It's easy to catch things with a curved hook. With a sharp hook, that's for those who really want to be free. So this no is really trying to take away everything that we would turn into a yes, that would be a thing, that would be something we would grasp onto, so that we can arrive at that yes, which is affirming of everything, but without any grasping. In the Surangama Sutra, the Buddha, Ananda asks the Buddha, if seeing and hearing are beyond birth and death, if we ourselves are beyond birth and death, are free, have enlightened nature, have Buddha nature, why is the Buddha said that we have lost our true nature and act in an inverted manner? Why is the Buddha said that we're deluded and we see things in an upside down way? And the Buddha took his arm and lowered it and said, at this moment, Ananda, is my hand inverted or is it in a correct position? And Ananda said, from an ordinary perspective, that would be called inverted, but I myself don't know which is inverted, which is correct. And the Buddha said, if I hold it, if a person holds this to be inverted, then which position is correct, is upright? And Ananda said, if you hold your arm up. So the Buddha held his arm up. This is upright. Then the Buddha said, if worldly beings so discriminate between an upright and an inverted hand, they will in the same way discriminate between your body and the Buddha's pure and clean Dharmakaya, the body of reality, and will say that the Buddha's body is completely enlightened, whereas yours is upside down. If you look closely into your body and the body of the Buddha, where is the distinction? Is there anything that is upside down? Then it says, after hearing this, Ananda and the assembly were bewildered and gazed fixedly at the Buddha without knowing whether their bodies and minds were really inverted. And so the Buddha said, your bodies and minds are just appearances within the wonderful, bright, and pure, profound mind. Why do you stray from this precious, bright, and subtle nature of your fundamentally enlightened mind and so recognize delusion within enlightenment? Why within the midst of this vast ocean do you say that you're thirsty? He went on to say, the mingling of form with fault with deluded thinking causes the latter to take the shape of a body. And stirred by accumulated causes, impulsive consciousness, within and drawn to externals without, such inner disturbance is mistaken for our self-nature. And so we mistake that which we see as inverted for ourself, for who we are. And so it would make sense that in seeing that we would see ourselves as somehow fundamentally deficient, lacking, inverted in some fundamental way. Such inner disturbance is mistaken for the nature of mind, hence the false view of a mind dwelling in the physical body and not realizing that this body, as well as mountains and rivers, space and the great earth, are but phenomena within the wondrous, bright, true mind. All are Buddha nature. Like a deluded person who overlooks on the great ocean, looks across the great ocean, but grasps at a floating bubble and regards this as the whole body of water in its immense expanse. That was kind of a perfect description of how we grasp at little bubbles passing by and try and latch on to that as our salvation, as what we need, as. This body of impulsive consciousness. That's why our practice is embodied. It is in the body. When you sit, you are sitting in your body, in the body of the Buddha. And in tension and tiredness and non-alignment and all of the various bubbles, there is a Buddha body. And so from the very beginning, you take that very position, the body of the Buddha. Right? We don't wait until we're enlightened to finally be able to sit in that, on that seat, in that position. We take it from the very beginning. We sit in that place of power, right? Which is looking in and out at the same time. Which is solitary and amidst the Sangha at the same time. And we experience, we see the bubbles arising, impulsive consciousness, the sankharas, the fruit of past actions, we see them arising. And we see our reaction. And we begin to, and we lose our way. We lose our ground, we flip over, we invert, we flip, we wallow, we waddle, we all kinds of different. And then slowly, step by step, we begin to find a little piece of ground, a little bit of stability, a little bit more stability, a little bit more stability, so that even when that reactivity arises, we don't react to it. And when we don't react to it, the reactivity begins to soften and fade. And then the impulsive consciousness begins to soften and dissolve. Going to the root. Bodhidharma said, this body is your real Buddha body. And this real body is your mind. It's your Buddha nature. It's subtle and difficult to see. It's not the same as the sensual mind, but it's not apart from it either. It's not the same as the sensual mind. Don't latch onto that bubble and say, it's you. Don't run after it and say, that's my ticket to my happiness. But it's not apart from you. See it arising. Know how to practice it with the whole body. Walt Whitman sang a song of the body electric. I sing the body electric. The armies of those I love engirth me, and I engirth them. They will not let me off till I go with them. Respond to them and discorrupt them and charge them full with the charge of my soul. Was it doubted that those who corrupt their own bodies conceal themselves? And if those who defile the living are as bad as they who defile the dead? And if the body does not do fully as much as the soul, and if the body were not the soul, what is the soul? So here, let soul be Buddha nature. If the body does not do fully as much as Buddha nature, and if the body were not Buddha nature, what is Buddha nature? That all of those many beings within us, outside of us, engirth us, encircle us, and we encircle them. They will not let you off until we learn how to go with them, respond to them in accord, in peace, in harmony, in unity. And along the way, we are discorrupting these impulsive consciousness. We are undefiling them. We are realizing they are not intrinsically defiled. And in that way, we charge them full with the charge of our own soul, our own Buddha nature, our own aliveness. This happens in our intimate contact. I know how difficult it is to trust that in our moments of feeling corrupted, entangled, reactive. It's hard to have faith in those moments that we are freeing ourselves. Because what looms so large is our lack of freedom. But just remember that the mind that is seeing that, perceiving that, coming to conclusions about that, is the same mind that created those very challenges. And so we have to see with a new mind. And so bringing to mind what is true in those moments, that we can't fulfill, realize our Buddha nature apart from these impulses, from these reactivities, from these samskaras. But we also just can't be driven around by them. And that right there, that middle path, is alive and takes our full attention. Good thing we're in session.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.